The technology is being developed now. It's being developed now by military, by the defense industry. So if the international community, the states, don't say this is prohibited, then everything will be developed. Once it's developed, it's too late.
Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of Multilateralism Unpacked, the podcast of the United Nations University Center for Policy Research. I'm Eleanor Fournier-Toombs, Head of Anticipatory Action and Innovation at UNUCPR. This year, the United Nations First Committee, which tackles issues of disarmament and international security, has been hard at work exploring the question of AI-enabled autonomous weapons. To most people, AI in warfare means drones that are able to identify and target specific people, for example, or robot armies and self-driving tanks. The capabilities of AI-enabled autonomous weapons have increased enormously over the last few years. Military expenditure on AI systems has skyrocketed in a number of countries, and we are now seeing the effects of AI in several current conflict zones. From an international perspective, war and conflict are regulated under International Humanitarian Law, or IHL. The foundation of IHL is the Geneva Conventions, adopted in 1949, which aim to reduce the barbarity of war and, if possible, make war more humane. The conventions include special protections for civilians who are not involved in armed conflict and for soldiers who are wounded or have surrendered. They also call for proportionality in the use of force to reduce the impact on people living in conflict. The use of AI in warfare has raised important questions in humanitarian law. How can AI-enabled autonomous weapons integrate principles of humanity and civilian protection, and should they be prohibited outright? I am joined today by Laurent Gisel, head of the Arms and Conduct of Hostilities Unit at the International Committee of the Red Cross in Geneva. Laurent has worked for more than 25 years at ICRC and brings extensive practical and research experience to the topic. His team has published several important reports on AI and humanitarian law and recently submitted evidence for consideration by the United Nations Secretary General in accordance with Resolution 79239 on artificial intelligence in the military domain and the implications of international peace and security. The ICRC is also mobilizing support for a new international treaty on AI in conflict. Thank you for being here. It's such an honor to have you here at UNUCPR in New York. So the topic of AI in armed conflict is one that is increasing in importance as more and more AI-enhanced weapons are currently deployed and more are under development. As the head of Arms and Conduct of Hostilities Unit at ICRC in Geneva, you have been at the center of this debate. You recently submitted a report to the UN Secretary General on the use of AI in a military domain, which was a part of the inputs to the SG report on the topic in preparation for the first committee. The question of AI in warfare raises a number of important ethical issues, whether it is a loss of life on both sides of a conflict, loss of human control and accountability, proportionality in the use of force, the cost of war, and much more. But what is key to our discussion today is how we can understand AI in warfare in terms of the existing international legal framework, namely International Humanitarian Law, or IHL, which remains a foundation for regulating conduct during armed conflict, even as technologies rapidly evolve. So let's begin by exploring how AI is used in military operations. From the ICRC's perspective, how would you characterize the current reality of AI used in warfare, and what distinguishes autonomous weapon systems from AI-based decision support systems in terms of the risks they pose?
Thank you very much, Eleanor, for having me this morning here to discuss these very important issues of the use of new technologies of warfare and therefore speaking, in fact, of the future of warfare and how we see that developing currently around the world in armed conflict and also being developed through research and development of military weapons. So in terms of artificial intelligence and how that's used in armed conflict, It's used very widely by military in many domains, for logistics, for autopilots, like when I came here on the plane from Geneva to New York, and that's also used by military in the same manner, of course. That's not what concerns us. Mm-hmm. What concerns us is when artificial intelligence is used in autonomous weapon systems or used in decision support systems, as you mentioned. And I will come to those two aspects in a second, also when it's used in cyber operations. But for today, let's focus on autonomous weapon systems and artificial intelligence in decision support systems. So autonomous weapon systems, that can be any system. That can be an anti-missile defense ship, that can be a loitering munitions, so a sort of drones that look for targets and then can come back to base, or, you know, fly down on the target and become a missile. That's the type of munition that already exists. It can be drones, where there are lots of reports that they have been used or not autonomously. So what is autonomous weapon system? It's when any kind of those system actually select and engage a target, so shoot on something or shoot on someone that the system has selected by itself without human intervention. The human activate the system, but then the system choose and shoot at something or someone.
Mm-hmm.
So some of them already exist, as I mentioned, anti-defense missile system on board ships, but that's being developed, the ones that are more looking for targets. But it's not always clear whether or not they are autonomous, because some of those systems, they can be used in a remotely piloted manner, loitering munitions, drones, etc. And when they are used in practice, states usually don't say, or military don't say, whether it was used remotely controlled or it was actually used autonomously. And that's the same for drones that are often said to be autonomous for the last mile until reaching and exploding on the target. And that we see that increasingly in armed conflict because of jamming capabilities of the enemy. So it can no longer be remotely controlled because the adversary jammed the communication. But maybe some of them will actually have a target that has been set by the human, so a target, a tank, or whatever objective that they will explode on, that has been set by the human before losing communication, and then the drone just fly and explode on that target mm-hmm. autonomously. Mm-hmm. That's not autonomous. The target, the tank, has been chosen by the soldier, while it could still could. That's homing on. That's not an autonomous weapon system. Or maybe some of them are actually autonomous. So after the soldier lose the contact, the system itself will select and then explode on a target. And that would be autonomous. And again, there is very little clarity in that respect, which can be two reasons. Military don't want to tell too much about their capabilities, but it also probably shows a reluctance by military to acknowledge they use things autonomously, because there is still some uneasiness in that respect. And we believe that's, in a way, a good sign that a state and military recognize that this raises particular questions. But what is there is no doubt is that there is a lot of development in the type of technology that is currently with increasing autonomy in the technology, including on those particular aspects of selecting and engaging the target.
It's really interesting. And I think I would just ask a follow-up just on this question of autonomous selection of target. How do you see those decisions being made? What are the factors that would make an autonomous weapon select a particular target?
So the way autonomous weapons would function or functions today is that they are based on information received by sensors, a different kind of sensors on the shape of an object or the speed, the directions, or any other information that are picked up by sensors, and then is analyzed by the autonomous weapon system, by the algorithm, against what is usually referred to as a target profile. So a definition of what could be a target. And then the system matches the information received with the target profile. Or at least that's how it's supposed to work. That raised the question, of course, that when the human user, the commander, the soldier launch the system, they don't know yet what will be the specific object or persons, we can come back to that later, but the specific target or object that will trigger the reaction of the system. Mm-hmm. And so the system select it and engage it. Therefore, the person doesn't know what will be targeted and doesn't know where and when exactly it will be targeted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there is an issue with regards to loss of human control on the use of force.
Yes, that certainly raises really important ethical issues, I think. And I was wondering if we could also hear your perspective on the risks of AI used in decision support system and kind of understand how AI is being used in that sense as well in conflict.
So AI decision support system, it's precisely different from autonomous weapon system because the decision to use force on choosing the target, so selecting a target and deciding to use force in that specific target at that moment remains with the human. And the system is only meant to support that decision by the human. But again, it's a computerized tools that would rely on bringing together lots of data that are collected by military information systems, sensors, etc., and then analyze that, but produce recommendations, predictions, analysis based on all of that rather than actually engaging directly the potential target. So they are also widely used in conflicts since a long time. They are used, for example, in civilian collateral damage assessment methodology or others. But now where we see a development is that they are more used to select a target quicker, faster. And that's why it's developed by military to accelerate the kill chain, as military would say. So that creates, of course, additional risk for civilians or other protected persons in the conflict. There are risks in terms of the data on which the system has been trained. There are risks that this data or the system malfunctions because, of course, in a conflict, contrary to civilian setting, the enemy wants to deceive you. So he wants to deceive the system. Mm-hmm. So whatever you have trained the system to do or to analyze does not necessarily work in a situation of armed conflict. So that, again, increases issues in terms of predictability of the outcome. And that's why it's important that the commander can reflect on the assessment or the recommendation that is being given. Not to speak of the question of automation bias. So the tendency of human to trust to the outcome, and the more the system is complex, the more there is this risk, the more there is stress for the person. And that's, of course, very present in armed conflict. The more there is risk that the human actually only rubber stamp the analysis of the system, and then in practice, it's no longer a support to decisions. The decision is taken by the system if the human just say, yes, I approve.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. To me, the question of bias comes up in a lot of different ways in the use of these tools. One is the bias in the algorithmic output, which you mentioned in relation to training of the models and the potential data sets that have been used. And this is something that we see across all kinds of uses of AI. But then the question of automation bias, which also comes up a lot. And I wonder if we will continue to have this severe level of automation bias. As human beings, we become more and more aware of the potential biases in technologies. But it's definitely true that right now, any study has shown that we have a strong preference for trusting AI outputs that might not necessarily be worthy of our trust. So I can see how that's quite important in decision support systems. I would love to turn now to international humanitarian law. And I was wondering if you could start by briefly outlining how the IHL currently governs the conduct of hostilities and where it intersects with questions of autonomy and human control in the use of force.
Thank you very much for that question, because international humanitarian law is key in all this debate. That's what makes limits to how conflicts can be waged to protect civilians, to keep some level of humanity in this extremely devastating situation that is an armed conflict. So the key rules is, of course, the principle of distinction. That's basically, in short, saying that it's prohibited to direct an attack to use force against civilians or civilian objects like civilian cars or civilian houses, prohibited to attack hospitals, etc. And it's not prohibited to attack a military objective, tank, a fighter jet, or a combatant. So that's the key principle. It applies across the board. It applies whatever weapons is being used, those of the past, those of today, those of the future. And that's key because we need that new technologies also are used in a manner that enable the protection of civilians to be upheld. And then there are principles that goes together with that, proportionality, precautions that also are key in this respect. Now, all those principles need to be looked at in the circumstances of the attack. And that can change very quickly. A tank is a tank and remains a tank. A missile remains a missile. That's relatively easy. Now, if you have a civilian car that is used by the military for military purposes at the moment, or the same for a school is used by the military, it has been evacuated and the military is using it as a barrack, then it may, depending on the circumstances, become a military objective. But it can also very quickly no longer be a military objective as soon as the military stop using it. And that's the same for people. As civilians, if they directly participate in hostilities, they can be targeted. But as soon as they stop participating in hostilities, they are again protected as civilians. And even combatants. Combatants can be wounded. So combatant soldiers can be wounded, can surrender, and immediately they become protected. So that's why it's important to look at in the circumstances. For autonomous weapon system and AI DSS, but especially autonomous weapon system, as we discussed before, when the system is activated and the user, the commander, the soldier doesn't know yet which object, which persons will be targeted when and how. But it needs to ensure that at the moment force is used, actually that person or that object is what we call a lawful target, is something that can be shot at. It's not protected, it's not civilian at that moment. So that's why you have an issue with regard to loss of human control and judgment on the use of force.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really clear that there's an intersection between autonomous weapons and IHL on any number of the different principles. And there's a lot of guidance provided by IHL on what to do. But some people argue that the IHL is technology neutral and already sufficient. But others contend it was never really designed for systems that could act with limited human oversight. So in your assessment, where does the current IHL framework remain robust and where might it fall short in addressing the unique challenges posed by autonomous and AI-driven systems?
We believe that the framework is robust. Globally speaking, the basic principles have been with us, so distinction, proportionality, precautions governs warfare, and they need to continue to do that. And that's a very important bottom line for that. Now, there are two aspects with those new technologies. First is how exactly the principles apply and the rules apply. And here we can have lots of discussions, but what we see currently is that the states and the military don't necessarily agree on how it applies. They agree with the principle, but what it means exactly for those technologies, they disagree. The other aspect is that even us agree that there is new questions that might be better addressed by development of the law. So an aspect is clarifying, having a better common understanding of what the current law says, but also developing the law for the aspect that are new, that brings new questions.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that there would need to be new principles developed or kind of an addition to international humanitarian law that really covers AI?
We absolutely are convinced that there needs to be a new law, meaning a new treaty, a new convention with regard to autonomous weapon system specifically, including, of course, autonomous weapon system that rely on artificial intelligence, because those ones are those where the problem is most acute, including when they rely on machine learning. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But we believe that there needs to be new law to clarify that in terms of what needs to be prohibited, because we believe some system needs to be prohibited and expressly so, and not all of them, but the rest needs to be restricted, that there are still guidelines and rules on how they can be used. And in terms of the system that, in our view, needs to be prohibited, it's two kinds of autonomous weapon system. The first one is those which are unpredictable.
Right.
So when the soldier, the commanders who activate the system actually doesn't know what will be the result, cannot explain the result, cannot predict the system. Because of course, if the soldier who activate the system doesn't know the result, they cannot ensure that this will respect international humanitarian law. They cannot ensure that civilians can be protected. And that's where AI and machine learning pose particular problems. Because if you have machine learning that makes that the system change how it operates after it has been activated, then you can imagine, of course, the one who activates, the soldier or the commander who activates it, doesn't know what the system will do. So that's very clear. From our perspective, that's already prohibited. If the commanders don't know what the system will do, it's prohibited. That's an inherently indiscriminate weapon that is prohibited, but it would be good to clarify that to make clear that everybody is on the same line in that respect. The other aspect where we call for prohibition is anti-personal autonomous weapons, and by that we mean those where the target profile is the human being. So it's not about the soldiers that are killed when an autonomous weapon system shoots at a tank and the crew of the tank might be killed as well. It's really when the target profile is the human being. And there are two main aspects for that. First is the question of complying with international humanitarian law. because I mentioned already before, soldiers can be very quickly become protected and therefore cannot be targeted because they are wounded already and
right.
they are protected, or because they surrender and they cannot be targeted. So that can change very quickly. Same for civilians who might have been at some point participating in hostilities. The second aspect is ethical, of course, because all autonomous weapons raise ethical issues, but of course those where the target profile is the human raise the most ethical problem. Mm-hmm. States have recognized that there is ethical concerns, but that's where the concerns from an ethical perspective is most acute.
That's really interesting. And in terms of your first category of prohibition, I think that's where we return to the importance of explainability. We spent about the last decade at least talking about black box and AI, and it's kind of magical. And part of the reason for that was a little bit of marketing and making it seem that it was going to be applicable for everything. But now it's really becoming a problem because, as you mentioned, in these life or death decisions, in really important security and ethical decisions, if it's magical and we have no idea what happens, it's extremely dangerous. So that's an important point, I think. And the question of anti-personal autonomous weapons is really leads me into the next question, because I think when people that are not involved in this process, they do worry a lot about this idea of killer robots and AI in warfare. And I think people tend to imagine an AI-enabled drone that would operate in a dense urban area and would pick out a dangerous actor among a crowd. I think a lot of people, when they think about autonomous weapons, that's what they worry about. They worry about robots and drones kind of being here and really targeting specific people. And that's something that, from your perspective, would be prohibited. But it also seems to me that it's far from current capabilities of AI. Do you agree with this? And could you explain how that would impact civilian protection?
Thank you for raising that question, because I think that's a very important one. Of course, the technology will develop, but we also, I think, need to be very cautious when we have very limited scenarios that are described by military to say, in that very typical specific scenario, it could be a better outcome. And I'm not saying that's not the case, but what I'm saying is that the experience of armed conflict, what we have seen over the last 160 years when we at the International Committee of the Red Cross work in the field, is that once the weapon is developed and once it's fielded, it's not only used in very small specific scenario. State don't develop a weapons program that could cost billions for one very small specific scenario. It's used more widely. And to take an example that I often used in this kind of discussion is the question of anti-personnel mines. Anti-personnel mines, if they had been used only to protect fixed military installations behind barbed wire, supervised biomines, with sign, etc., you would have much less problem than what we actually have seen in conflict, where they have been used so widely everywhere, leading to the fact that it causes indiscriminate effects. 80% of those who are killed or injured by mines are civilians. So that's a staggering number. If you recall that the main principle of the law of armed conflict is to protect civilians and only direct your attack and use force and kill military and target military objects. 80% are civilians for the effect of mines. So again, the specific scenario of no, but we can use it lawfully around the barrack, it's not what we see in reality. And I'm very concerned that this would be the same here when I hear those small scenarios. Now, of course, that brings back the broader questions of the control on the use of force and sending such a weapon in a densely populated area where you have plenty of other persons, and what confidence can a commander have that actually that will target only combatants and combatants that are not wounded at that moment and not surrendering, and you don't know how many civilians are around that combatant at the moment where the autonomous system would actually shoot on that specific combatant. You have so much uncertainty that it creates huge risk for civilians. And that's why among the recommendations for the use of those autonomous weapons that would not be prohibited, even for anti-material ones, it's not to use them in cities. Because even if it's a tank in the middle of a city, you don't know how many civilians are around it when it's engaged by the system, because you don't know when and where the system will engage. And that's, again, magnified if it's against persons.
Yep, that's a really good point. Another area where I think some states might see or might present a gray area is in the distinction between AI used in military offensive and AI used in a defense operation or just to provide strategic information. Do you see that as a distinction here in our conversation?
I don't see that as a distinction, but that raised the question at two levels, whether they say in defensive operations, meaning when it's a conflict that is waged in self-defense, as opposed to other types of conflict. And here there is a very clear distinction. International humanitarian law applies to all parties to the conflict, whether or not they started the conflict or whether they are acting in self-defense. And that's key for the respect of and the protection of civilians in those conflicts. In addition to, of course, all the very important rules that you find in the UN Charter on when or not a state can go to a conflict. Now, if we are talking more on the question of a tactical level, whether that's an offensive attack or defending against the enemy attack, there is no difference for weapons and for weapons use. The rules are the same. You need to attack only military objective, and whether you offensively attack the weapons launch of the enemy, the site where the missiles are launched, or whether defensively you shoot at the missile, the rules are the same. Now, the challenge here, I think, is more on the type of place and the type of targets. Because if an autonomous weapon system that is used offensively against the tank battalions in open space outside of cities will create much less risk from our perspective, humanitarian risk, a risk for civilians, risk of compliance with international humanitarian law, than a defensive systems in a populated area against a person. So it's more, from our perspective and our analysis, the concern are more linked to the type of targets and the situation of use, not whether it's offensive or defensive per se.
So I think finally, I'd like to turn to the next steps for this. So there's a huge amount of movement in this space. You're in the middle of negotiations. There's been several reports inside of the UN and outside of the UN on these topics. And so what I would ask you is, what pathways do you think have the most promise for regulation that supports IHL?
So we are very clear with what is needed with regard to autonomous weapon system. It's to have a new treaty, and states for that needs to start negotiations. The fora where they want to do that is not the most important issue. It's really moving to negotiations. Now, this is being currently discussed in Geneva as part of a convention and a group of governmental experts that is not the United Nations General Assembly here in New York. But of course, it's also discussed here in New York. But the discussion are more advanced in Geneva. The question is that there needs to be decisions by state to move to negotiations. And we are not yet there, but there are an increasing number of states. And actually today we have recorded that there is a majority of states that have actually expressed the view that there needs to be new legally binding instrument, also a new treaty, a new convention on autonomous weapons system. The discussion on other use of AI, so AI in decision support system or AI more broadly, is less advanced for the military use. As you pointed to, there have been discussions in many places, regional attempts, multi-stakeholder discussions where you have the states, but also other actors that are outside of the formal UN system or formal treaty mechanism. And all of that are very important, interesting. Now, this question has been now brought to the UN General Assembly last year, and that what led to this process of consultation where we made the submissions. That is the reason we are here to discuss it today. And we find that very important because the General Assembly is, of course, the place that is most inclusive in terms of all states being here to discuss that. And it's also done for the time being in a manner that is also enables other actors to participate and to provide their view to support the discussion by states. And so both civil society, international organizations like us, technical experts, because that's also very much important for that domain. So in that sense, we very much support that the General Assembly continues to discuss that. Maybe in the future, that could be through a more established and strengthened mechanism that exists currently. So like what is called an open-ended working group, which is a type of group where all states participate and have fixed meetings throughout the years to then report to the General Assembly. That's not yet apparently what states will decide for next year, but maybe it will come later and we think that would be very helpful.
Do you see resistance among member states in terms of moving forward on the treaty that you suggest? And if so, why would they be resisting?
So as I mentioned, a majority of states are in favor of having a new treaty, but that means also, of course, there are some who are not ready to do that. And we have heard at least two types of explanation. One is what sometimes states or their military branch in particular or military forces say that they want to keep maximum operational flexibility. And of course, that comes with a concern for us because that means they don't want to be too much restrained by rules, the purpose of which is, of course, to protect civilians and to protect schools and hospitals from being affected by the conflict. So it's normal that military wants to retain some level of operational flexibility, but I don't think that in and of itself is a sufficient reason to be against a treaty in VNO analysis, at least. The other explanation is that it's too early, it's too complicated, the technical aspect is developing too fast, so the rules that we would adopt now will be, you know, already outdated shortly in a couple of years. But I think that's an argument that is actually very dangerous because that leads to adopting no rules. Because the technology is being developed now, by military, by the defense industry, by technical companies that now provide also services to the military, developed algorithms, etc. And they are doing that now. So if the international community, the states, don't say this is prohibited, therefore we build only that, then everything will be developed. Mm-hmm. And once it's developed, it's too late. It's much more difficult to walk back than to have the states first say, this is out of bounds. This is the red line. So let's develop only the rest. And we have seen that already a number of years ago, there was a letter signed by thousands of AI scientists to call for guidance by states on what can be developed for armed conflict and what cannot be developed for armed conflict. So scientists are also asking that question. And that's why it's urgent to have those negotiations now, because otherwise the technology will decide what are the limits and we don't feel that's promising.
Absolutely. I completely agree to your point that those that are arguing that it's too early, and it's not just states, it's also companies that are arguing that soon it will be too late. And I think that's why there's so much activity right now on AI governance in all domains. So as states move forward, hopefully towards these negotiations, certainly to developing their own policy positions in this domain, what would you like UN member states to keep in mind?
That the most important things when looking at new technologies of warfare is keeping the human perspective in the first place. The human, of course, as a user, but most importantly, as the human that risks being affected by the use of weapons, both civilians, but also combatants, because some weapons create unnecessary suffering and they are also prohibited. So keeping in mind the human at the center to ensure better compliance with international humanitarian law, and that's for how the human use the technology, and for better protection of civilians on how they are used.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I learned a lot, and I think it's incredibly important work. So thank you for representing also the work of your team at ICRC, and we really enjoyed speaking to you today.
Thank you very much for having me today.
That was Laurent Gisel, head of the Arms and Conduct of Hostilities Unit at the International Committee of the Red Cross in Geneva. Thank you for listening and stay tuned for future discussions on AI and the impact this rapidly evolving technology has on peace, security, and the multilateral system.